that is here, and there's no question that the Arctic and the climate are changing.
State lawmakers address climate change, sort of. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, February 9th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, middle school teachers say an increased workload is harmful to students.
I don't know my kids. You know, I don't know them the same way at all, so I can't really help them, which is what the middle school model was.
That's tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Alaska Children's Trust, working to prevent child abuse and neglect by encouraging all Alaskans to take small steps that can make a big difference in the lives of Alaska's children. Information at alaskachildrenstrust.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Children's Trust.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
When it comes to climate change, Alaska is seen as a bellwether. Temperatures have risen nearly 4 degrees over the past 50 years, a number that's double the national average. But even though Alaska figures in discussion of climate change nationally, it's rarely a major topic of conversation in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez examines why.
The last time there was legislation specifically focused on climate change was in 2006. There have since been energy efficiency bills and air quality bills and resolutions pushing back on air quality regulations, but nothing that gets at the massive, complicated issue of climate change. So it was a bit unusual to hear legislators air their opinions on the matter last week.
It is here, and there's no question that the Arctic and the climate are changing.
The discussion kicked off when Senator Liesl McGuire, an Anchorage Republican, led a press conference on a new report on Arctic policy. The document lays out the positions Alaska should take as sea ice melts and different nations try to carve out influence in the Arctic. The word climate appears nearly 30 times in the document, occasionally in the context of an investment climate. The word opportunity appears in equal measure. Over the course of an hour, lawmakers focused on the possibilities for resource development, for increased commerce, and for private investment to the tune of $100 billion. McGuire described their approach as realistic.
The development's going to happen with or without Alaska. It's already happening.
The climate change discussion bled into other committee meetings. At a House Resources hearing, Representative Benny Nagyak, a Barrow Democrat who caucuses with Republicans, expressed dismay at federal rules meant to protect species from climate change.
Everything created in this world has to learn adaptive capabilities to changes in anything in their lives.
Some, like Anchorage Democrat Andy Josephson, pushed back on the statement that the ecosystem is that resilient.
We are the poster child because of the change that is so self-evident and I think empirically proven at this point.
But it was Representative Craig Johnson, a Republican from Anchorage, who seemed to capture the pervading attitude in the building.
I am not certain that if we shut down every development in the state of Alaska, moved everyone from Alaska, and moved them out, that we would have any effect on climate change.
Which all goes to highlight.
Alaska is a tough place to talk about climate change.
Michael Tubman worked on energy and environmental issues for Governors Sarah Palin, Frank Murkowski, and Tony Knowles.
It's also a microcosm of the whole issue. We're actually seeing the effects of climate change and the costs associated with it. At the same time, the fossil fuel industry is a very important part of the state's economy.
Tubman is now a fellow with the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions. And he says there's a tension where the state is dependent on oil production for its economy and, at the same time, vulnerable to a lot of the immediate effects of those same fossil fuels. And as those effects are becoming more obvious, the national conversation about it has become polarized.
I think over the last 10 years, we've seen climate change from a bipartisan issue that was able to be discussed with different types of solutions coming from different types of governors and federal officials to a far more partisan conversation. And that's been really unfortunate.
So climate change is kind of an elephant in the room. The state needs to figure out how to deal with its effect on infrastructure and industry. But tackling climate change itself can seem too ambitious and maybe even contrary to the state's economic interest. Tubman thinks there are a few things that can be done at the state level to address climate change beyond mitigation. He points to other resource-rich areas. For example, Alberta has put a price on carbon while still maintaining a healthy oil industry, and Texas has made big strides in wind energy. As far as development of Alaska's resources go, Tubman says that can be done in ways that reduce emissions. Tubman also thinks it's worth reviving something like the climate change subcabinet that existed during the Palin administration.
There is a lot of value in having an ongoing conversation where people can look at this long-term issue from all different angles.
Larry Hartig has served as the Commissioner of Environmental Conservation since 2007, and he was part of the subcabinet while it was active. He says the Walker administration is currently discussing its strategy for climate change and sees it as a significant challenge.
Our glaciers are getting smaller. We're seeing higher rates of coastal riverine erosion, where surface ponds are disappearing, draining away. I mean, you can't sit there and say it's not happening.
Hartig says he wants to re-examine the work of the climate change subcabinet to find out what's changed and what work still needs to be done. Basically, Alaska doesn't have to solve climate change. It just has to start dealing with it. In Juneau, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
An Anchorage lawmaker has introduced legislation that would allow terminally ill patients the right to decide to end their lives with the help of a physician. Democratic Representative Harriet Drummond said in a release that this is not suicide, but rather is an option for people who are already dying. HB 99 was introduced in the Alaska House on Monday. It would allow adults suffering from a terminal illness and deemed capable of making a decision to die to do so. It would allow for the person's doctor to dispense or write a prescription for medication that would end the person's life. Halibut harvests have been on the decline in the Bering Sea for years, but the amount that trawlers and catcher processors are allowed to take incidentally has stayed the same. Now federal regulators have agreed to consider stiffer limits on halibut bycatch. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal has more.
This weekend, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council voted to study the impact of cutting their 10 million pound bycatch limit by as much as 50%. Councilmember Duncan Fields introduced the measure.
Unless we act and act fairly decisively as soon as possible, we may continue to face what could be an emergency in a subsequent year.
Halibut fishermen narrowly avoided a major cut to their catch limit in the Bering Sea this winter. The International Pacific Halibut Commission, which sets those limits, decided not to go ahead with the reductions, as long as their counterparts on the North Pacific Council agreed to take a second look at bycatch restrictions. Those are written into federal policy. The council has the power to make changes, and they have requested voluntary reductions across the fleet. But as Karen Pletnikoff pointed out in public testimony, the cap hasn't officially changed in over a decade.
In that time, how many fish, jobs, and dollars would the Bering Strait, the Gulf of Alaska, Southeast, and beyond have had and could have if this bycatch survived to recruitment?
Pletnikoff is a manager for the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association. She pointed to shore plants in Atka and St. Paul that rely on deliveries of halibut to keep business going and stand to benefit if there's less bycatch and bigger harvests. But representatives from the trawl fleet warn that tighter limits could create an economic burden on their side as well. The exact impacts aren't clear yet, but a draft study provided to the council showed that a 35% cut could cost one group of catcher processors up to $368 million, mostly from fishing less to avoid halibut. On that front, Captain John Nelson said he's not sure how much more he could do. His vessel, the Rebecca Irene, has already changed its fishing schedule and added excluder nets to let halibut out.
And we've been working with these tools a long time. The excluder really has been dialed in to be about as efficient as it can be right up to this year. Beyond this point, I do not see, in my experience, a lot of gain. Any increments of gain, which we will continue to try to make, are going to be very small.
Nelson said he does see promise in new tools like deck sorting. Instead of going inside the vessel to be tallied, halibut bycatch is checked right on deck and thrown back if it's viable. A few boats got permission to test that method under an experimental permit over the next year. In the meantime, the North Pacific Council has pledged to work with the International Halibut Board and figure out better tools for estimating stocks and bycatch between the two of them. The reductions will come back for review during the North Pacific Council's June meeting in Sitka. They're scheduled to take final action at that time. In on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, how much can a grocery store mean to one small town?
He said, you know, I've been really, really thinking about your store. And he goes, you've created a cultural revolution here.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Artist, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. The deadline is March the 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Middle school teachers in Anchorage fall into two groups, elective teachers and core class teachers. Before this year, all of the teachers were given extra time to collaborate and try to ease the transition of students from being kids in elementary schools to young adults in high school. But this year it's different. Elective teachers don't get time to collaborate, and some say it's students who are losing out. KSKA's Ann Hillman visited Wendler in Midtown Anchorage and has this story.
About 120 students crowd into the Wendler Middle School gym, practicing skills for the Native Youth Olympics. PE teacher Nadine Price and two others jump from group to group, giving directions on the stick pull and the high kick. It's precisely controlled chaos.
You know, as long as they're moving and active and not getting her safety, like, see, these guys are doing it backwards. Oh, but they figured it out. A lot of times if you give them a minute, they will figure it out. And you let them try it. It's trial and error, and then keep them moving.
Soon, the period ends, and Price books it down the hallway to get to her health classroom, where students are already waiting.
This is my my stack of paper that I'm trying to grade for a week, because, you know, you never get time. And I tried to do it Friday after school, and that didn't work. But
she trails off as she starts chatting with students, then launches into a class on bullying. Soon, the class is over, and her planning period starts. But instead of working on grading, more students file in to eat lunch in Price's classroom.
Why are you guys eating lunch in here instead of in the lunchroom?
Because it's peaceful in here.
Yeah, it's peaceful in here.
And Miss Price is in here, and we love her.
And there's a lot of drama going on in the lunchroom all the time.
Like, what kind of drama?
Like, rumors spreading.
And lies and stuff. Mm-hmm. So.
John Quinones and Mohassan Sharif say the drama makes middle school tough. And then you add in the homework. Here's Mohassan.
I mean, this is just middle school, and it's all, like, already a little bit complicated for me. So imagine high school, where it's like, where you have to be responsible for yourself and all that. So it's a scary thing.
So they seek out the support of their teachers, which is why core teachers have an extra team planning period to make sure their students are thriving. But now elective teachers don't get that period. So teachers like Price often give up their personal planning time. PE teacher Christine Sager says the lack of team time is hurting her relationship with her students.
I don't know what's happening in anything else in this building. I have no idea what any teacher is doing. You know, I don't know my kids. You know, I don't know them the same way at all. So I can't really help them, which is what the middle school model was.
Middle school elective teachers started teaching 6 periods per day instead of 5 this year because of budget cuts. Math, science, language arts, and social studies teachers still only teach 5 per day. Elective teachers think it's unfair. Most core teachers at Wendler, like Piper Jones, agree. Jones says team planning time is invaluable for discussing how to coordinate classes and how to help kids.
If we want to pull in a student and have a one-on-one time with them,
without the pressures of having the other classmates nearby, where all of us pull them in together and talk to them about, hey, we've noticed you're kind of on the downhill slide, what's up? And usually if you do that, they break down and they tell you what's up.
Team planning periods are also used to develop interdisciplinary units, analyze testing data, and plan motivational events like ice cream socials to reward attendance. Jones says it's harder to communicate with elective teachers now, and she feels sympathetic for their extra class load. She understands why there is tension, because elective teachers are being treated differently. But it's important to note that not all core teachers feel the same. Andy Holloman with the Teachers Union says some don't think elective teachers need the extra time. He says the middle school model is implemented differently in each school, and elective teachers play different roles.
The principal is in a position to make sure that teachers are delivering on the expectations, and there have been times when that hasn't happened. And so to some degree, some core teachers are looking at it and going, I see some people that just have additional planning time.
But Holloman says the situation is fracturing the schools and needs a long-term solution. But that could depend on the budget, which is yet to be determined. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Affordable housing is an issue across much of Alaska, and Anchorage is no exception. The city ranks in the top 20 most expensive housing markets in the nation. The Anchorage Economic Development Corporation sees it as one of the biggest barriers to improving the city's fiscal future, and as KSKA Zachariah Hughes reports, the group wants to start addressing the problem by focusing on homelessness.
The Anchorage Economic Development Corporation recently applied for the IBM Smarter Cities Challenge Grant. If awarded, IBM will send a handful of analysts along with some sizable computing resources to Anchorage to begin crunching the numbers on how much homelessness costs the city. After determining the price tag, they'll offer the most cost-effective solutions.
Homelessness, if we don't address the situation, becomes more and more of a drag on our economy in terms of attracting that new investment and that new blood that we need in professional workforce.
Bill Popp is the president of AEDC and sees the high cost of homes as hurting two very different groups. There are the younger, more mobile professionals deciding whether or not to settle in Anchorage, and there are lower income individuals and families that are more likely to suffer homelessness than simply move elsewhere. From Pop's perspective, the shortage of affordable housing units is the common issue hitting both groups and costing the city resources.
If those pieces aren't in place, then your successful investment of dollars in the community become less.
Should they win the grant, AEDC will work with other Anchorage organizations to collect the numbers showing the real story of how housing prices affect Anchorage residents. The focus on homelessness as the starting point for a larger conversation, says Live Work Play director Arshana Mishra, came from local community groups.
All the organizations that we have talked to, they have homelessness as an important issue.
Mishra is hoping the grant will provide an opportunity to put together a data set, one showing how much the city spends just managing its homeless residents through a patchwork of social and emergency services compared to alternative housing options. Anchorage is competing with other cities from across the globe and won't know for several months whether they've won the Smarter Cities grant. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Enroll now in the health insurance marketplace. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Open enrollment ends February 15th. Depending on your income, age, and family size, you may be eligible for discounts that may lower your monthly cost and out-of-pocket expenses. Pick a plan that is right for you and your family. Call 211 for free individual assistance about the health insurance marketplace. Visit GetCoveredAlaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by Ashna, a partner of Get Covered Alaska.
The Environmental Protection Agency has issued updated standards for wood-fired heaters. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The new Environmental Protection Agency wood heating emission standards reduce smoke output by two-thirds compared to current levels set in 1988 Allison Davis with EPA's Air Quality Standards Office stresses that the new standards, which take effect this spring, only apply to newly manufactured units.
If you have an existing wood stove or other wood heater, this rule does not affect you. You can continue to use that.
Davis says the EPA is allowing retailers until the end of this year to sell off wood stove models that do not meet the new emission standard, but adds that most units already do.
The majority of adjustable burn rate wood stoves sold in the U.S. today actually meet that limit. So we think that we'll have a lot of wood stoves that are already available that will meet the limit.
The new standards also cover previously unregulated units, including wood-fired boilers. But Davis says some of those appliances are also already up to the new standard.
A number of manufacturers have been participating in a voluntary program with EPA to make cleaner units available, and a number of those will already meet the Step 1 standards for those heaters.
A second tier of stricter wood heating emission standards will take effect in 2020, covering new units manufactured and sold after that date. States are allowed to additionally limit emissions, and Cindy Heil with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation Air Quality Division says recently updated state standards for new wood and pellet stoves are initially stricter.
DEC's standard is a 2.5 gram per hour from 2015 to 2020, where the EPA standard is 4.5. But then 2020, our standard would remain the same at 2.5, and EPA's would drop to 2.0.
Heil says that's also the case for Alaska's wood boiler emission standard, and that the state of Alaska will have to revise all its wood heating appliance emission standards in 2020 to come in line with federal regulations. In Fairbanks, with help from Tim Ellis, I'm Dan Bross.
Haines Junction is a small town in the Yukon Territory at the intersection of the Haines and Alaska highways. It has a couple of restaurants, but no grocery store, until recently when two locals opened the Little Green Apple. KHNS's Emily Files reports.
The Little Green Apple opened on December 16th, and the crowd that showed up is an indication of how much Haines Junction wanted a local grocery store.
It was a zoo.
Paula Polovich and her partner Bill Carmen are the store's owners. Polovich says an empty building next to the gas station, which they also own, was begging to be a grocery store. She and Carmen had no prior experience running a food store. They had to teach themselves and build the shop from scratch. They took out a loan. Polovich looked at products and distributors, as well as the logistics of bringing food in from Vancouver, Edmonton, and Whitehorse.
I don't know. I probably have about 10 different suppliers. It's a very complex business.
An added complexity comes from the kind of niche store Polovich wanted to create. The Little Green Apple has some mainstream products, but Polovich says the food skews toward organic, all-natural products.
The store is very different than a typical grocery store, and I think people were anticipating another little highway stop, shack style, junk food, processed type of store. And it's just not that. I mean, it's a great little place where you can buy good snacks and stop and get a coffee and grab a fresh sandwich.
One challenge they face is pricing. Polovich says some people complain, but there's no way she can compete with big stores like Walmart. Overall, Polovich and McKellar say people have been happy with the store, and it's become more than just a place to buy your lunch.
People are coming to the grocery store, and they're visiting, which is really neat to see. And then they shop, and they exchange stories about what they found in the store. And anyway, this one gentleman, he was kind of just looking at me, and he said, you know, I've been really thinking about your store and what you've done here for the town. And he goes, you've created a cultural revolution here.
Polovich thinks with the gas station and grocery store combined, they're probably one of the biggest employers in Haines Junction right now. And she hopes to hire more people in the summer months. The Little Green Apple is open Monday through Saturday from 10 to 6 and Sunday from noon to 5. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
Brent Sass leads the Yukon Quest sled dog race. Sass left the Pelly Crossing checkpoint at 3:25 this morning. Hugh Neff followed at 6 a.m. Your Olsom, Jeff King, and Alan Moore round out the top five. On the Yukon Quest trail, there are a few things mushers have to be especially picky about, including a sturdy sled. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, jumble ice near McCabe Creek, halfway to Pelly Crossing, is testing sled engineering this year.
When he's not running dogs, musher Cody Strath builds dog sleds for a living.
I built the same sled I built for about 10 people this year, but it's a nice sled, and it was originally my design for myself, so yeah, everyone, there's a bunch of them out here.
Strath built a smaller version of the same sled for Brent Sass, who says he changed only a few things before the race.
I put new runners on it before I left, because we had a pretty rough season bouncing around in tussocks and bare ground and gravel, and it got pretty wore down. I put some new foot pads on that are a little bit softer. I did extend my brake pad a little bit, so I have a little bit more stopping power.
The smallest sled on the trail may be Jeff King's. That design has a slightly shorter bed and rides high. King also tows a trailer behind him. Some mushers think it's too hard to manage two sleds instead of one, but King scoffs at their skepticism.
I shouldn't be any more worried if I've built it well as somebody with long runners who's trying to carry the same amount of weight I am, only I'm spreading it out into two sleds.
King's sled was among many tested in rough jumble ice on the Yukon River, halfway to Pelly Crossing. The ever-reserved Yor Olsom said simply, quote, it was bad.
Some of it was really high taller than the sled. It would punch your feet off the runners, and the dogs would fall down into cracks, and then some neckline broke because they fell down and then they got dragged, and one dog crashed into like a big sheet of ice, and the sled is just all over the place.
Olsom had his sled shipped from Norway, but it almost didn't arrive on time. He had to send a handler to Toke to pick it up the night before the race. He says he was up late that night putting it together. On the Yukon Quest Trail, I'm Emily Schwing in Pelly Crossing.
Finally tonight, we have a correction to a story we ran Friday on the Rochelle Waterman case. Her appeal was denied by the Alaska Court of Appeals, not by the Alaska Supreme Court, as we reported. We regret the error. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal in on Alaska, Ann Hillman and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Emily Files in Haines, and Emily Schwing on the Yukon Quest Trail. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited announcing the 2015 Board of Directors election, encouraging e-proxy or paper proxy submission no later than Tuesday, March 10th before 5 p.m. Information at doyon.com.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. If you're not covered by health insurance, you may be eligible for financial help with monthly premiums and out-of-pocket expenses. Open enrollment ends on February 15th. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Last year, 88% of Alaskans who enrolled received financial assistance. Compare plans and see if you qualify for financial assistance. Call 211 to get free local help. Visit getcoveredalaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by Ashna, a partner of Get Covered Alaska.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.